This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A sign that love will always win. 1,000 million smiles I bring to you across the miles. In my land of sunshine or in your land of snow, makes no difference where you are if you let your feelings show. 1,000 million ways to love each other every day. For the boy and the old man, for the mother and
this is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Throughout this morning, you've been hearing the name Sudirman Arshad because BFM is celebrating the man who was a lawyer, composer, musician, journalist, cartoonist, writer, entrepreneur. But as this is Front Row, we lean towards Sudirman, the performer, musician, and actor. And to help us go beyond the public information available online, we have Razman Asrai, better known to us as Atai.
Hello, hi.
Who is also Sudirman's, I quote, favorite nephew. We also have Daniel Dranikanen, who was Sudirman's manager.
Yes, that's right.
Welcome, both of you.
Thank you for having us here.
Thank you very much.
Atai, how are you related to Sudirman? On your mother's side, your father's side?
Well, Sudirman is basically the youngest of the children, and my mother was the eldest sister. So I'm basically his nephew, and somehow or other I became his favorite nephew.
How many years are you separated from him? Because being he's the youngest and you're born of the eldest daughter, so there must be a few years.
Right, between me and him?
Yeah, how many years?
I'm 43 now.
He would be 63, so 20 years apart.
20 years apart.
20 years apart, okay. So when he started singing, you were just a babe in arms.
Well, yes. The thing is, when he started singing, he always performs and practices right in front of me as a child. And he'll take every feedback that is needed. He will make sure that he'll ask, Atai, what do you think about if I do this, if I say this and do that? It was kind of like a fun thing for me. I would always criticize him. I'll tell him, no, this guy is better. You did this wrongly. You're not that good and all that. So he would always want to please me when I was a boy.
My goodness. And to think that he produced a couple of your songs.
Yes, he did. Yeah, I think he was very kind enough. He was at a certain stage, at a level where he can actually produce songs. And, well, we were singing together most of the time off stage at home. So he said, Atai, I think I want to make sure that I do something good for you so that you're having a brighter future. So it went on just like that. You know, I was just a boy. I wasn't thinking. I was just saying, okay, whatever you tell me to do, I'll do.
How old were you then?
Well, I started appearing on TV for his video when I was 7, 8, you know. And slowly I appeared in various other TV programs all the way to when I reached 15 years old. That's when he started making an album specifically for me. Yeah.
Daniel, did you know about this young man when he was the 7-year-old?
Yes, I knew because he gave us a lot of problems.
Atai gave you a lot of problems.
Yeah, a lot of problems. You know, his criticism and his, his honesty. Oh. That's what
he was critical.
Atai was very critical about, and he always preferred other artists compared to his own uncle. So his uncle felt that, he had to prove something to this little tiny tot. And he's basically an accidental performer as well. Atai was just happened to be there because, you know, his parents were in Labuan. His father was Yang Diputor Labuan. So his parents went to Labuan to administer the state of Labuan. So the home here became vacant and this young tiny tot was there. So Sudirman also had a responsibility to take care of him at the same time. He literally had nowhere to go and he had to watch all these excruciating rehearsals and painful critics. So he became such a critic that Sudirman personally would come and tell me, that boy, I think I can do something with his criticism, but I would like to do something with his honesty instead. But you know, that prompted Sudirman to go ahead and create a own path. I mean, every art form is mostly stolen, you know. Creative geniuses always steal from something that's been done before. I wouldn't say Sudirman stole it, but what made him unique was he made it his own. He took pieces in everything from elsewhere. So that's Atai for him, you know.
But Atai, what kind of training did you have so that it allowed you to judge him with a critical eye?
What kind of training?
Sarcasm. Well, the spirit of sarcasm born into him.
When I was a boy, I was introduced to many of his friends. My friends were his friends. So the artists, the singers, the band players, they were my friends. I did not have any friends my age. So I can see everybody's performances and the fact that he exposed me into various other music in the world, like looking at Madonna, looking at Michael, of course, Michael Jackson,
Prince, Queen,
and all that. He introduced me to all the kinds of songs. That's when I compare him to everyone, basically.
At what stage did you realize my uncle can sing?
Huh. I haven't reached that stage. No. Well, actually, the thing about my uncle is, to me, he's an extraordinary person because he not only can he sing, he can perform, he can entertain, he can draw. There is nothing. Or if you tell him, he got a sponsorship to do medicine, he can actually study very well. He can excel in whatever things that he puts his hands
and
onto.
And his mind too, yeah.
I knew he was he's got a talent, but at the same time, I keep on comparing because at the end of the day, I want the best out of him. And at the end, of course, also, I just want to tease him as well.
Daniel, you came into the picture a bit later.
Yeah, when I was working, Mike Burney's was the manager who was managing him from 1981 to about 87. I was working with Mike Burney first. Mike Burney, who was our mentor for so many other people in the industry today, was managing most of the biggest acts, and Sudirman was one of the acts at the time. And I was doing sound for him, so that's how I got to meet Sudirman and do work for him, but I was working with Mike. And that laid the ground foundation. That was in 84, 85. Then I left Mike, and then in 87, one of his musical directors was a common friend, Jenny Chin, told me that he was looking for me. He had a split with Mike, and he was looking for me to manage him, actually, bluntly. And
actually, there's a major difference there. Like for Mike Burney, he saw Sudhir's act, and he said, Sudirman, I can make you greater than what you are right now. It was Mike Burney going to Sudirman. In Dharani's case, I think it was Sudirman, my uncle, looking for Dharani. It's a totally different...
So what did he see in you think?
Bluntly, he told me, he appreciated the knowledge that I had in the technical part of the whole performance, because he's basically a visual performer. You know, he needs his sound to be perfect when he performs, because if you look at the performance of Sudirman, he is so astute into every minute detail. That means he watches how the audience reacts to his songs. If they are responding correctly, he knows every song is a theatrical performance. Every song. You're talking about 12 songs in a normal performance. So for him, he's looking into how the band sounds, how the audience looks at, and what kind of costumes is for next song, what dancers are going to be. He's thinking of a million things. So he needs to hear himself very clearly. He needs the lightings and the technical parts of the show to be last on his mind. He doesn't have to worry. So one thing is off. So he wanted me, and that's what I did for him when I was working with Mike. So when I left Mike, he said, I would like to see this part of my career develop. And he said I had ambition, so...
Where did his talent come from? Just God-given?
Well, it runs in the family. That's number one. I mean, being extrovert, my grandmother is really the first politician lady in Temerlo, Pahang. And then my mother was actually the first singer in the family with a band of her own, singing in weddings and whatnot. And my late uncle saw that. And of course, Tan Sri P. Ramlee played a major role. Puan Sri Saloma, those are the people that he looked up to as well. And I guess he just simply loved entertainment music.
In what way did you say P. Ramlee and Saloma influenced him? Did he meet them personally when he was at the early stages of his performance?
He used to go and see Saloma and very often. The last years of her life, she used to visit her many, many times. and he used to ask her questions about how did P. Ramlee think of this, think of that, how he took this approach, how he took that approach. She used to literally sit down at her feet and just banter, and she loved it for him. She loved him for that. I could see the banter going on. I could take her. She was in Ulu Klang somewhere. You know, every time I'll have to take him there. And he just swallowed everything. He wanted to know. He's very curious. So they had a fantastic relationship.
In terms of his vocal range, what was his range? Because I hear that he's a tenor.
And also partly soprano as well. Partly soprano as well, tenor soprano, you know. But, you know, his vocal ability is, he can go down to even sometimes very low baritone, if you look at it that way. But his most comfortable range is that tenor soprano, you know, slightly, not the full scale soprano, but he can reach those high notes. And his ability to sing was so, I mean, he never went to any trained vocalist to learn vocalization. But actually, Simon Napier Bell did say this about him. You know, Simon Napier Bell, who was a manager for Wham and who organized the Salem Asian Music Awards, he said he performs as though he has had the best training in the business, because no one can perform and dance and prance about on stage, keeping that vocal ability and coming out, hitting those notes. Like, those notes were crafted for him.
Because I watched this video and he performed 1,000 Million Smiles for that Salem Award. Mm-hmm. Started with the singing, and then the tempo changed, and then he took off his jacket and he was dancing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
He had to hold those notes while moving at that kind of pace. That requires training.
Right, right. When he did that performance, I told him, yeah, you did 70% of what you could have done.
Yeah.
He is critical.
He was kind. He was kind. He was very kind. 70% is already like, oh, very kind, man.
So did he have to learn how to dance? Because he wasn't just moving to music. He was dancing.
Sudirman's strongest asset, if I may say so, he understood so clearly the importance of the visual performance. It's a very fine line. Visual performance entails not just the ear canal, but the eye gate as well. For him, both must work in tandem. He never gave anybody watching him any reason to take their eyes off him. That was his level of benchmark. For him, it's like, I must give them something to watch. Listen to me, no problem. They can play my CDs in their comfort of their homes, in their cars, wherever, that they can listen to me anytime on the radio. But when they come to watch me and pay me for my performance, I will give them something not to leave behind.
So he made it a very clear distinction between a recording and a performance on stage.
He gave his all, you know. No matter what he did, he gave his all. He never half-stepped into anything.
In the Sudirman tribute at KL Pack, you sang Send in the Clowns.
Yes, I did.
Right. What's the connection between that song, you and Sudirman?
How? Well, you know, when I was a boy, he always takes me to his shows. And in fact, one of his shows, he would ask me, boy, do you like my show? And I say, no, I don't. And and he quickly grabbed me by the collar and said, do you really like my show? And I said, okay, yes. But out of all his shows, it always ends with the song Send in the Clowns.
Smile and Send in the Clowns. It's a combination of the song Smile, which was Charlie Chaplin's classic, and Send in the Clowns in the middle, which he arranged by himself. It's an original.
Yeah.
Except for the songs were written by Charlie Chaplin and Send in the Clowns for the Broadway play.
So was he trained in terms of like composition so that he knows how to arrange music? Or is this something that he picked up while being in the industry?
Well, he learned a lot, yeah, in cabarets.
Yeah, you know something about him, like I said, he always took things and made his own, you know. Yeah. He would cut pieces of music between Queen and Charlie Chaplin or some Broadway West Side Story kind of thing together with some local elements. And he always mixes and mashes and he sees the whole picture. How am I going to be looked upon on stage? When I'm on stage, how is this going to sound? Is this going to give the dynamics? Is this going to give the... He thinks about all that. He made his own.
Was he trained? Did he...
No.
He just wanted to tell the story.
Yeah.
Whether he was trained, I think...
Sorry, I think I can answer that. Yeah. I think while doing it, that was a training. He would take that to the musical directors. I mean, we like, no, sometimes you don't need to go to a proper educational facility to learn certain things. While doing that, it was a training. He took it to the composers, he took it to the arrangers and the musical director and said, hey, I want it like this. And he will actually, in those days, it was such a tedious task because you had to buy this cassette to cassette transfer thing because you didn't have anything digital. He will wait, cut this part out, put it and record it here and then take off. And five songs could be in a whole one mashup, but he will do that and he'll give it to the arranger, the musical director. I want it like this, okay? You take this song to this song from here to here, take that song from here to here, put it out together, and then the arrangers and the musicians and musical directors will do it for him the way. And so it was a very tedious task. So that was his training, if you ask me, you know. I mean,
it's himself, yeah, right.
What about the dancing?
Well, he does have a dance choreographer, but he can make moves to a point. He's been trained with so many various choreographers that at one point we were doing a video, music video, and he can just create one dance scene at one go, and he'll remember that move again and again. And I'm 15 years old, and yeah, I had to catch up with him because I had to do it within that split 5 minutes. He taught me, this is how you move, like this, like this, like this, like this, like this, and I just couldn't
learn the steps fast enough.
Learn it fast enough that he said, "Atai, what you are so ngongye."
I'm speaking with Razman Azrai, also known as Atai, Sudirman's nephew, and to Daniel Cannon, who managed Sudirman. The occasion of today's show is BFM's commemoration of Sudirman's anniversary. Coming up, what kind of legacy has this performer left for us Malaysians? This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Salamku yang terakhir. Balik kampung, oh, 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 balik kampung, oh, 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 balik kampung, hati girang. You're listening to Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. National music charts in the country in the 1980s, it was dominated by Sudirman, who passed away 25 years ago today. To celebrate and commemorate this musician's contributions and its mark on our popular culture, BFM has dedicated much of today's programming to him. In the studio are none other than his favourite nephew, Razman Azrai, also known as Atai, and Daniel Cannon, Sudirman's manager. How far outside of Malaysia was he known, Daniel?
There's this one diehard fan of his called Ramlan, who's got a whole web page and a whole blog dedicated to Sudirman. And I think he's got fans from about 100 over countries there, from Tunisia, New Zealand, all logging on to see what are the latest postings about Sudirman. So, and when he won in Royal Albert, London in 89, he had fans from as far as you could remember, even Africa, you know. And because I think his reach just went further and further.
But that was before the internet.
Yep.
Right?
Way
so
before.
How did they hear about him?
There were many foreigners living in London, obviously. And then, you know, word of mouth is the best form of advertising. But there was a lot of promotion in London for him. He was going to the next level.
And this was on account of the competition, or this was even before the competition itself?
There were a lot of foreigners that endeared to him because he performed to a lot of very international and a very varied audience. Most of his shows here, even in Paddock, he was the first Malaysian to perform in Paddock in 83, I think, if I'm right. 83, 84. And that already was a stepping stone for him. And he was also Malaysia's official tourism ambassador. Tourism Malaysia at that time took him to many countries from Middle East, Britain, Australia, New Zealand. So wherever he went, not necessarily were a fan of his, but many of his fans became fans of him after watching him perform. They write letters to him. Hey, I caught your performance here and there, and I've spoken to my friend. How can you give us your albums? Where can we get them? Of course, albums are not available like in Spotify. And, you know, the day you had to write to EMI Malaysia, and he will send. He was one of the first artists that I knew who probably had about 20,000 copies of his works in his house that he will send out to all his fans.
I know of somebody many years younger than myself who was a fan of his, when she had to go to medical school in India, her mother would cut out all kinds of news clippings, send it to her. She would write to Sudirman and would get something written back in his own handwriting.
Personalized, always.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for him, his fans, whatever that his fans sends, it must be treasured. So there was one time at home, my mother moved some of the fans' mails to another place, and he got so angry, you know, that is so sensitive, do not touch the fans' mail. Yeah. That's how he loves it.
He loved his fans so much, you know. As of any other artist, most of the artists, you can see that they know one distinct fact, which is it's your fans that make you. And, you know, you have to respect that and appreciate that. So he always never flinch from the idea of being closer to his fans. They have fans coming from Johor Bahru, from Perlis, at the late nights into his house
coming
asking.
To the house,
So he had that door open and he never would turn them away. I'm not saying this to, you know, exemplify, but that was his attitude. He knew the importance of fans in the craft that you're doing. He said, if I don't do this for my fans, who else is going to appreciate it? So,
how would you describe him as a person, Atai?
He's a very humble but also very brave person. He's daring enough to do things where people say you can't do. You know, Chowkit Road, that was something where everybody, even the government, was telling him, you cannot do this.
I read about this Chowkit Road event. How did it happen? I mean, people came. Was this like an announced concert, or was it a concert? Did he charge tickets? How was this done?
It was like this, you know. He was actually Malaysia's tourism ambassador at the time. Malaysia was celebrating PATA, the Pacific Asia Trans Tourism
Association.
Yeah, that's right, for PATA. So it just occurred to him and said, because all the PATA delegates from the whole Asian region were here. It was a very big event. And he came up with this idea very nonchalantly and told Mike Burney, his manager at that time, let's do something for the masses. I want to do this myself. Please get the authorities. Of course, the first authority we had to go to was who's
BBKL.
Now? No, not at that time. At that time, it was, we're talking about 86, right?
Okay.
Yeah, and that time, we had Mike managed to get an appointment with Tan Sri, who's Tan Sri now? Dato' Zaman Khan, who was the chief police officer of Federal Territory in Selangor at that time.
Now, at that time, a lot of the police officers told him, you don't have a chance today.
Yeah, exactly. Before Mike went to see Zaman Khan eventually, all of them said, please, give it up. We cannot do this. This is Chowkit Road. That's where the whole thoroughfare of the entire bustling, the whole vein of the heart of the city is. You can't stop anything there. You can't build your stage and do what? Yes. Are you crazy? So he went through all that, and that's what he revels on. He said, okay, great. So he told Mike to go and do one final thing, try to go and get the chief police officer, Zaman Khan, and see what. Went to Zaman Khan,
hold on, before that.
Sorry, yeah.
Before that, Zaman Khan was my father's schoolmate.
Yeah.
And Zaman Khan even told through my father that this will not happen.
It won't work. So tell him don't waste his time. Tell him don't waste his time. Because Zaman Khan already knew. And Zaman Khan was like, and it was relayed back to him. And he said, no, I want Zaman Khan to tell me. So please get the appointment. So here Mike and Sudirman went. Zaman Khan switched on the whole. At that time, they had a very substandard, lighted map of the routings in KL. And, you know, Sudirman, if I stop this road here, you know what it's going to cost? The entire city is going to be backlogged. I can't even give it to you for 1 hour. You ask me for even 1 hour. Even on a very higher scale, we can't lock down the road. Certain roads we can lock down. That's why we always tell foreign dignitaries, presidents, and he started and he went into this lecture trying to tell Sudirman, give up, please. Don't push me into saying yes. But I do not know what happened. I do not know. When they ended the meeting after 3 hours, Dato' Zaman Khan Zaman Khan, after telling him about why he cannot, and he, of course, Dato' Zaman is a very astute man and he was very diplomatic and very kind, and he showed the problems it was going to cause. But Sudirman seems not to be deterred by anything. He kept his foot down and just kept quiet, swallowing up everything that, this is what Mike told me, you know, Mike related to me the whole story, and I was working with Mike at the time. So he said, I don't know, sometimes I also feel like giving up. That's what Mike felt. But Sudirman did not even flinch an inch. He just felt that he's not going to take no for an answer before he leaves the room. So he says, no, I want to do this. So finally, Zaman Khan made a couple of calls in their presence. And Okay, I'll give it to you. Your show shall start at 8 o'clock. You only can close, shut down from 6 o'clock. Sudirman said, no, please, I'm not asking for the full day. Can you just let my people build just a basic stage from 2 afternoon onwards? Oh, that's 6 hours before showtime, huh? And to build up a stage in the middle of Chowkit Road was going to be not just a gargantuan task, but it was going to be near impossibility. So the logistics that they planned was ridiculous, way beyond any possibility. But they did it.
And it happened.
And it happened, never mind. It was a free show, to answer your question whether anybody paid for it. He paid everything by himself. Everything was born out of his own pocket. Nobody expected, like what they say, 100,000 people coming. We were at the tip of Chowkit Road. Okay, as an example, where today would be the main intersection in Chowkit, behind the Federal Hotel on the other side, right up to Pratama Complex. That is Jalan Tunku Abdul Rahman, right? Chowkit Road, right? There were no multiple screens. The sound system was good enough to probably carry only 30 meters from where the stage was, but there were people right down 150 meters right down to Pratama Complex.
Not hearing anything much.
I do not know what they were doing.
They just wanted to be there, maybe.
Yeah, they all came to see the show, but they couldn't move because people, the roads were shut down at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They started building their stages.
The crowd people came in early.
People were already there. Yeah. People already there seeing the whole setup, the rehearsals. And, okay, like they say, this kind of things can only happen by the presence of divine intervention. So that's what happened.
No, Atai, you were saying that he's a very humble man, a very brave man, doing things that people would probably say no, like right. This Chowkit Road event. I also read that he was going to have a performance at UKM, and that was there was a protest, and it was cancelled, and then it later happened.
Right.
What were the circumstances then?
He, in fact, received a lot of threatening calls and mails at that time. And but again, like Chowkit Road, it was something that he said he really need to do for his fans who is in UKM. They have not seen anything in the past decade, so he wanted to give this great performance for them. So he will give it. He won't care whether there's these threats and whatnot. And luckily enough for him, even the Prime Minister actually helped, as I understand.
Yeah, at that time it was Dato Sri Mahathir. Yeah. And he said, if Sudirman wants to hold his show, let him hold his show. Shouldn't be a problem at all. And the Prime Minister said that, he went on.
What was the objection to his performance?
I think the fact that a lot of people think he represents the West society. Some of his shows were considered to be having women dancing, and that would not be right for our kind of culture at that time. I mean, it's still happening now. Yeah.
But, so do you think if he were alive today, would his concert be less controversial?
Nope.
Since
he would have probably made it more controversial.
It will be more controversial.
And you know something? If controversy is basically what we look at it, we are so hypocritical in our way, seriously. He saw so much of foreign culture coming here with no problems. Yet when he did something, everybody just harps on him. It's like if it's the greatest crime on earth that he's committed. So that hypocrisy had to stop somewhere, and he didn't. And he didn't do anything to provoke. What he did was everything was with style and taste. He tried to keep it with all these considerations before he did something, you know. And it was hard. It was so hard for him.
What do you think is his legacy for us?
For me? You know, Sudirman used to be an entertainer. Today, he's just a memory that reminds us, a reflection of the past memories. I don't want to say this. I honestly think that we should just forget about Sudirman, to be honest.
Why?
Because I think during his lifetime, and even until today when he's dead, people don't really treasure what they have. And he was abused. And I think even till today, he is used. I went for this BFM interview because this BFM interview called me up 1 month before the actual day. And they really prepared well. Where else? Other people, they would just call me to the very last day. And whether I'm in or not, it doesn't matter. That's number one. I think number two, Sudirman had greatest people around him. It wasn't just Sudirman. It was even Dharani. It was even Jenny Chin. It was even Mac Chu. There's a lot of people who have done great during his time that helped permuted him to a level where he is. And I believe that even those people around him are not appreciated in the music industry. So forget about him, you know. I mean, if we do not know how to respect talents, let's forget about it.
But the very fact that even though it was posthumous, that he was given a datuship, isn't that some kind of a recognition?
That datuship is a state datuship, by the way. It's recognized by a state. And to me, today, in that datuship, you throw a stone, you get someone with the datuship. So, and by the way, honestly, I do not mean to say that, well, he should be getting a Tan Sri or whatever. No, that's not the point. The point here is that we should respect and learn from Sudirman. We should have him, children, institution learning about what happened those days. You know, who actually made it, his music, who made those music, anything about him. And no one seems to be doing it, not even a small museum for him. So, yeah.
Well, based on my knowledge, at least KL Pak and Yayasan Saim Dabi has initiated a scholarship in his name.
Yes, yeah. That's the greatest thing. You know why? Because the people in power might not be helping him, or rather, the people in power are using him, but the people like in KL Pak, the people that are basically the citizens of Malaysia, the rakyat, they still remember him. It makes me crazy because it makes me feel, you know, at times I want to do this for his fans, for the people who knew him and all that. But at the end of the day as well, I know that the stakeholders, the people in authority does not really know how to appreciate him. So I would say forget about it, you know. That's what I feel.
Daniel, what do you think is his legacy for us?
He left a fantastic legacy. We will never know how to go forward unless we know how to look at what was in the past and where they came from, like what he did. What made him great was basically he went and studied up everything about performing arts from everybody that he could study, from the days of Sammy Davis Jr. to James Brown to every name, P. Ramlee and Saloma and everything, and that what eventually made him. And if some of the people of today don't even know who Sheila Majid was or who Zainal was, because like what Tai said, I would think the industry or us, or I don't know who, but somebody's got to be responsible, not for the sake of anything, to document whatever happened in, you know, our whole culture. It's a preservation of why herald somebody when they're gone. It's too late. BFM probably in 25 years, this was the first station that actually called us 1.5 months before asking us to fix this date for this interview. And all credit, and I'm not saying anything about the other stations or other people who want the interview, but it's a mindset. You know, you all have a plan and you knew and you did your research. All your interviewers did your research, knew everything about you need to interview us for. And that's exactly what's needed. We need a place beyond just a website or a blog that talks about this guy. And he told me something very, very sadly. You know, he said, you know, Dan, you'll probably still be around after I go, but you know what? They'll probably give me some accolade or some honorific titles. Yeah, tell them to take that and go and put it very politely in my grave, because it will do no good for me, but my fans will remember me. So I'm not belittling any authority here, but I feel that, yes, he left a legacy which was, I hope even some one person could become bigger and more pronounced than me in what I'll be very happy. And they said they learned it from Sudirman. That'd be great.
As far as his music is concerned, I understand he wrote most of the lyrics himself.
Yeah, and also songs.
If you were to put them all together, what do you think is his artistic vision? What is he saying through his music?
He's resonating himself with the people of not just people in the city, but the whole of Malaysia. So when he wrote Balik Kampung, which is by The Star, the most famous song of all time.
The most popular song of all time, Balik Kampung was voted.
Balik Kampung. And it relates to every single one, not just in the city, but also in the suburban and whatnot. And Chow Kit Road, again, the same thing. He just wants to connect with everybody. Chow Kit Road, Chow Kit Road, Chow Kit Road, Chow Kit Road. When Tun Dr. Mahathir created Punch Card, he created a song for it because everybody was talking about Punch Card. Now we have to do Punch Card. So it's something that he will use it.
Would you say he's an activist of sorts?
Yes, I would say that. He was an activist in the sense.
He stood for something.
If I were to ask you for, I know he has many songs and they top the charts. If I were to ask you for a couple of tracks that might be your favorite, what would they be, Atai?
My favorite track is actually Dia Tiada Lagi, which is a song that was written way back in early 1980s or 70s. Somehow or other, it stuck to me till today.
Daniel, what might be yours?
Wow. I don't have one because there's too many. It's like asking me to choose which of my children is my favorite.
I've been talking to Sudirman's nephew, Razman Azrai, also known as Atai, and to Sudirman's manager, Daniel Cannon. They have been sharing with me the history and music of this singer, musician, artist who dominated the radio waves and the country's music charts during the 1980s. Sudirman died 25 years ago today, shortly before his 38th birthday. He was awarded a Datuship posthumously, Dato' Sudirman Haji Arshad. He would have been 63 this year. This is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Mudahnya meminta, sukar diterima. Menikah engkau bagai sebilu, menghiris.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.